together forever. You're listening to America's most crypto parapsychological podcast, The Pod People. I'm Matisse Van Rossum, but the ladies call me Vanilla Fudge.
Glad you got that one out.
I'm Ben Sheets, and for some reason, Mathri-chan just won't stop following me.
Teach about a spit take there. You good, bud? Yeah?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay, cool. Well, hi, I'm Cleveland Mosier, and they must have amnesia. They forgot that I'm him.
Welcome back, dear listener. This week we're bringing you another Patreon pick episode. The film we're talking about tonight was chosen by our honorary pod boy, Micah. And we are going to be talking about a 2005 J-horror film, Reincarnation, directed and written by Takashi Shimizu.
What incarnation?
Reincarnation.
Reincarnation.
You heard it here first, folks. We're coming back from the dead. Yeah, this is, like I said, a 2005 J-horror movie about a film production that is recreating a grisly murder at a spooky hotel, and the lead actress starts to have a bunch of weird, spooky visions.
Ghostly visions.
Yeah, ghostly visions.
I think this film is an interesting little jambalaya. It's an interesting little stew of
starting off with the food metaphors. All right,
I love them. I really do. It's a nice medley of The Shining, Perfect Blue, and One Cut of the Dead. I think.
Okay, like, I haven't seen One Cut of the Dead.
I'd recommend it.
I definitely, I do get the,
it's
especially
a fun movie.
The Shining.
That's a movie I was hoping to do on the podcast without either of you seeing it, but I guess
you've
seen it.
I have seen One Cut of the Dead, and it's great.
That's a shame.
Yeah, I won't spoil anything.
For the podcast. It's a great movie, but it's a shame.
Yeah, that we weren't coming into it fresh for that one. Yeah. But yeah, well, Tease can be baby on that one.
Yeah, I'll be baby on that.
No, I've thought about picking it too, actually. It's a delight. It's a fun movie. But you see without spoiling too much, you see why.
Yeah, but I don't know. I feel like in this it's less about that. It's the, you know, little pinch of something in the stew. It's not like as big.
Yeah, I mean the production of it is what really reminded me of it too. You know, the fact that they recreate the set, that you get so much of the movie making in the movie, like
I can see that. Yeah. I can see that.
But you know, equal parts Perfect Blue for the same reasons.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you mention like a stew or a jambalaya because like
it is funny. I agree.
It feels like Shimizu kind of throws everything into the pot and hope it turns out well.
And lets it slow cook.
Yeah, like, I had just watched...
And there's kind of a lot of waiting around, but then the bite that you get at the end is
pretty
tasty.
Good. Yeah, it's a good bite.
Well, I just watched The Grudge for the first time a couple weeks ago, and he also did that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's similar to this movie in a lot of ways. Like, the biggest thing is the kind of relentless pacing of scares and jump scares, but it also has some of the same problems that this movie has in that, like, it gets so lost in the sauce of scares at a consistent clip every 5 to 6 minutes, I would say, that it kind of becomes a little convoluted or incoherent at times for the sake of the scare.
Yeah. I've not seen The Grudge. That's a blind spot for me in terms of J horror. But it's interesting that you describe this movie as like relentlessly paced with jump scares, because like there is a heavy presence of ghosts in this movie, but I don't know if there's, like, I don't know many what I would consider, like, true jump scares. Okay. Like, the ghosts are always showing up, they're always around, and in that sense, like, I know what you mean. But I actually found this movie paced, like, pretty glacially. until it, like, really picks up in, like, the last 20 minutes or so.
Yeah, well, it's funny because it starts really fast-paced with a lot of, you know, disparate,
it's setting up a lot very quickly.
Spooky scenes in
a
row.
That's fair. Before the opening credits.
Yeah.
I like the spooky scenes.
Yeah, I mean, like, again, like, they are well put together. They can be a little cliche, like, I've seen them before, but that might just be, you know, context. Like, we've had so many J-horror movies.
Yeah, I do kind of agree that it's a lot, though. Like, I almost wanted a little bit more restraint, like, early in the film, so that it could sort of, like, climax more effectively. Like, I think the last, like I said, like, I think the last 20 minutes is really, like, where the movie won me over in a lot of aspects, and it gets, like, really weird and cool, and we'll talk about that. But I think that some of that is kind of lessened by just, like, how often we're seeing ghosts, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's honestly what it reminded me of is like some of those Mike Flanagan Netflix shows, like the haunting shows,
where
there's like always a ghost in the background. I think Mike Flanagan does that a little bit more subtly, like these ghosts are less subtle. But yeah, it is kind of one of those things where it's like there's like always a ghost in the background, pretty much. You know, either just like standing and lurking or walking around or, you know, coming up behind somebody or something. So like, yeah. Yeah, it is, in that regard, it doesn't play its cards, like, very close to the chest, I don't think.
I agree that, like, in the last 20 or 30 minutes, it definitely won me over.
Yeah.
But especially, you know, with the repetition of, like, the spooky shots that we get from the beginning through the rest of the film, like, setting them all up at once at the beginning of the film feels like just a mess of, like,
yeah, well,
random
it's
stuff.
The thing about this movie is that in order for its climax to work, it has to put a lot of pieces on the board and sort of like bring them all together. And I would say in like the first couple of acts of the movie, it, like, in service of doing that, it makes some decisions that I don't think are, like, super effective, like, in the moment. Like, by the end, I kind of understand the necessity for it.
That's, I think, what I liked about the beginning to midsection was, like, trying to kind of unravel the mystery and figure out why they were making those choices. I think the biggest one is why there are really two main characters that never interact, like, throughout the course of the film.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And I was wondering how their paths would collide. And it's not set up in a way that feels like there's polarization between the two of them. I just kind of kept being surprised that they hadn't, like, coalesced yet, that they hadn't, like, met. And
their stories
by the end, like, it made really good sense, and I really liked that.
The payoff with that is good. I agree.
I called it like right, I won't say it yet, but I did. I called it like right before it happened, which I think is good. Like, because it all tethered together, and it did make sense to me by the end. Like,
yeah, absolutely. Like, but you definitely bring up a good point with the treatment of like the two protagonists, because what they're experiencing is very similar. They're sort of in parallel, but like you said, they never like cross paths until the very end, to the point where there are a couple of times where I not paying super close attention, like, would get them confused. You know what I mean? It helps that one of them is in many of her scenes wearing a shirt that says Vanilla Fudge. So I could bright orange shirt that
iconic.
Says yeah, so that made like she's wearing that shirt in like a lot of her scenes. For the couple where she's not, I'm like, "Oh, is this our other character?"
Wow, pretty racist.
Yeah, I guess.
Honestly, you know. Like, I mean, totally different haircuts, that, totally like, different, like... Yeah.
They don't have a ton of personality. I don't think that's what this movie is really going for.
I found our key protagonist, like, the actress, to be, like, incredibly timid, and then the other to be, like, fairly outgoing and confident. Like, I thought they carried themselves in very different ways, personally.
Sure, but they don't have, like... They're not... deep character.
No. There's like, yeah, beyond what I said, like, that's about it. Yeah.
They're pretty shallow, and like in that respect, I can understand getting them confused, doing minor things where they're not showing how timid or outgoing.
Well, the movie has a kind of like dreaminess to it, which is necessary for the blending of reality with the dream or with the spirit world or whatever, that is thematically central to the film. But a side effect of that is what you're saying, that like the characters feel more one-dimensional, kind of, it all has this sort of like kind of dreamy detachment,
mm-hmm.
And I think that is, that definitely contributes to my issue, telling them apart at times.
Yeah, and I don't even think it's necessarily a flaw or anything.
No.
This movie isn't about that. Like,
right.
And honestly, having us, view the movie through either one of their eyes is, important, especially for the themes of this movie.
Yeah.
But it's all,
ritual and reenactment and, kind of falling into archetypes.
Yeah, it's all very reliant on unreliability as well. Like I said, those lines being blurred and not being able to tell, what's real and what isn't. Story-wise, this is a new film production by, some acclaimed horror director who is... making a new movie called Memory that is a sort of stylistic recreation of a massacre that happened at this kind of remote resort hotel back in the 70s, where this professor went crazy and killed his family and a bunch of people at the hotel.
40 years ago, evil dies tonight.
Evil dies tonight. Well, I mean, you mentioned The Shining earlier, and this movie is obviously like very, very heavily inspired by The Shining.
Which is funny because, Mike Flanagan is also.
Yeah.
Right?
Like, well, he did the Doctor Sleep movie,
and he's worked with Stephen King, and I think you can see that he's sort of pulling from the same well when he puts the ghosts in the backgrounds of his film as The Shining. And so I think that's kind of neat, too, that's sort of why I think there's a convergence there.
Yeah, thematically. We even get, a repeated motif of, room 227 rather than 237.
Yeah, well, spooky girls in corridors.
The funny thing about that, too, is in that scene where she's wandering around the hotel and, she sort of starts having a vision that the killer is chasing her or whatever, she tries to go into room 237, but it's locked.
And then
she goes around the corner and goes into room 227, which is where the girl she's playing was murdered. So yeah, and very similarly to The Shining, I think this movie is kind of trying to establish that this place is evil and cursed and haunted or whatever, and it's not so much about the individual ghosts, but rather this sort of dark nexus that has drawn them all to this place, but yeah, so 11 people were killed here back in the 70s. They're making a film, and our protagonist, our first protagonist, is cast as as an aged up version of the killer's young daughter, who was the last to die. They're building a replica of the hotel in the studio, but one of the things they do early on is they take the whole cast to the old hotel, which is, dilapidated and run down. And
looks great.
Yeah, it's cool.
Like, the set design is fucking perfect in this movie. I love it. I love the first off, I just love the look of the hotel.
Yeah.
Great location.
Well, for this kind of thing, you know, it's good. The location has to be as much of a character as as the actual character. It is. Just like the Overlook.
They do a great job too, like matting in that, like, you know, nasty stormy sky over it too. It just looks so ominous and foreboding.
I like
weird orange roof. Like, it looks so cool.
I like the couple of like establishing shots they have of the town where like the bus is driving in. You can see the whole town laid off, and then off in the distance you can see the red roof of
you
the
can
hotel,
almost hear like, you could just about, if you listen hard enough. And I like that. I think, I do too. This movie is doing enough on its own that it's a cool spin on it. It's a new flavor on an old dish, and it works really well.
And it's from the perspective of like an entirely different culture that, you know, that has its own sort of like traditions of ghost stories and hauntings and the supernatural and stuff like that. So to see like that kind, like an Eastern spin,
yeah, J. Horror Shining
on the Western story of The Shining. Yeah, it's cool. I'm all for that. Makes way more sense than like a fucking, I don't know, fucking German like Shining.
Well, I'd give it a try, but
sure, why not?
Another thing to note too is that one of our previous notes is there is a bit early on when the director gathers the whole crew together, and he specifically says to them, this is an ensemble cast film. There's no singular protagonist, and the killer is just going to be a shadowy figure that haunts the rest of the movie.
It's about the victims, not the killer.
Right. And that the fact that he plays it up as it being about an ensemble cast helps illustrate the structure of the film itself that we're watching, right? That, like, there isn't just a singular protagonist. And that, to me, kind of softened the blow of there being that secondary figure, is I was kind of seeing how if that would play out the same way, poetry, rhymes, etc.
Well, this movie ends up being, like, kind of an in-betweener, because, like, it's not, this movie is not really, an ensemble cast film. Like, we have a couple of protagonists, but, you know, there's parallel stories that eventually intersect, but, like, the rest of the, you know, the actors playing the victims are totally non-characters. We never get much insight into, like, who the director is or anything. Like, we get some shots of him, you know, he's got his apartment set up with his fucking Pepe Silvia board of, like, the, you know, all the crime stuff. But, you know, we don't really know about him. So it is, like, it's not really an ensemble film.
It really isn't, but, like, I do think having the two protagonists gives it a little bit of variety. Like, I feel like in the second act, like, if we would have just stuck with one of them, it would have dragged a little more than it does.
Yeah.
It would have dragged, and it would have made, I think, the sort of, like, relentless horror way worse. Because if our, like, our actress had experienced both of those characters' situations, by the end of it, I think it would have been almost silly, like, that she would have experienced all that and not left the film set or then whatever. But, like, she experiences, in my eyes, like, enough for it all still to make sense.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I think the biggest problem with our secondary protagonist, I'll just call her Vanilla Fudge for convenience. I think the issue with Vanilla Fudge is that, in contrast to our other protagonist, our actress, like, I don't think Vanilla Fudge is very well set up.
No.
She sort of appears in the movie.
She just kind of appears, and I think that contributes to some of the confusion about them as well. It's like, yeah, she just kind of appears, and she doesn't have any connection to the film that's being made, which adds some additional distance. Because, like, you know, we're talking about, like, there always being ghosts and stuff, but, like, it's pretty much, except for, you know, some of the early stuff before the opening credits, but it's like it's all around the production of the film, right? Like, the film feels haunted, and, you know, like, even outside of the hotel, you know, we're seeing the ghosts in the studio and stuff like that. But then, you know, we've got Vanilla Fudge, who is talking about how she has dreams of this hotel that she's never been to, so on and so forth. It's like, it feels very disjointed.
What's really cool is, if I'm remembering correctly, because this film has a lot of ethereal qualities, it's a little hard to grasp on after just coming out of it, but if I remember correctly, she's introduced out of a dream. And I like that. Like, if I remember correctly, it's our actress character begins dreaming about the hotel, she walks up to the door and sees the doll, and then she enters the hotel, and then through the glass there's a reflection and she can see out, and then Vanilla Fudge comes up to the hotel and picks up the doll, and she's watching her, she doesn't realize, and she's kind of trying to, like, reach out to her, but she can't.
Yeah.
And then Vanilla Fudge wakes up in her classroom. And so they're almost, like, connecting in a dream, always together. And I think that's kind of pretty fucking
together
neat.
Forever.
Together forever. Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, again, understanding, like, how the film ends, looking back at that sequence, I think it's really cool.
Mm.
One thing we haven't talked about yet is I think, one of the most important characters of the movie, and that's the fucked up doll.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about the doll.
Mathri-chan, as Ben named her very cleverly.
Yeah. It's a very large doll. I think just perfectly unsettlingly large. It's like, what I would say, 3 feet tall. In height.
Probably 2 feet,
yeah,
I would say.
It's
yeah,
very
2 feet tall.
Reminiscent of, like, porcelain dolls, but with a kind of unique facial structure.
Yeah,
it's kind of wall-eyed a little bit.
Yeah, its eyes are sort of, like, bifurcated and looking out in opposite directions, which is, like, fairly, like, somewhat common in, like old, like, Japanese, like, horror paintings of, like, demons and stuff.
Oh, yeah, sure.
One of my favorite examples of that is in a really dumb anime called, I can't remember the name of it. It's Fate Stay something. I forget. It's
great recommendation, Cleve.
But there is, like, there's a cool version of, like, Bluebeard in it, like Bluebeard's Castle Bluebeard, and he has those same, like, eyes that stick out, and it's like really spooky the way that they play it up.
The doll is great. They get a lot of use out of the doll. I know Ben made an Uma Thurman Joe the Uma Thurman doll. I called it the fetal alcohol syndrome doll.
Fetal alcohol syndrome?
Yeah, sure.
why not?
It's very uncanny.
Yeah. To great effect, in my opinion.
I mean, like, they get so much mileage out of it. Yeah.
And I think most of the mileage works, too. I think
a lot of the like most effectively creepy stuff in the movie is centered around the doll, which, you know, I will say, I mean, it's not like this is a new movie or anything, it's 20 years old, but kind of refreshing to see, like, a scary doll in a horror movie that is actually, like,
scary.
Yeah.
That's, I think, why it works, is it's actually well fucking designed. Like, it's well made, it's well crafted, there was intent behind it, and it's not just a cop-out of showing, like, a porcelain Victorian doll.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of horror movies,
I
think a lot of horror movies, and, like Annabelle is a great example of this, is that, like, the haunted doll is just, like, so evil looking that it's, like, not actually scary. Like, it becomes, like, kind of like a caricature of a haunted doll.
It's evil. Yeah, like, in this movie,
and it's like,
it's
this movie
wrong.
It's like, yeah, it's uncanny. It's not like it doesn't look like an evil cursed doll. It's just very, like, just
it's
off
fucked up
just
looking.
Off enough with its, like, yeah, it's big fucking wide spaced eyes that are just a little bit too far apart. It's like, yeah, that's to see it come looming out of, like, a dark hallway or something. It's like, yeah, that's spooky.
Yeah.
I think they almost imply, or they maximize the implication of spookiness in, like, the introduction to that doll, too.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause it's, like, in that intro sequence where we're seeing a lot of disparate, scary stuff, and, like,
various people interact, like, being
and we see
scared by ghosts.
The doll on the ground, and like the face like caves in, and like the glass eyeball is like sticking out,
mm-hmm.
and it's super spooky. Legitimately super spooky.
Yeah, I was creeped out by it.
But like, even it's really smart to start with that, because even when we see the doll like in better condition, like we're still thinking about that a little bit.
Yeah, you know? Right. And it's like every now and then we'll see it in that form with like its head partially caved in and the eye popping out.
You, to me, a really stupid comparison. I'm going to make it anyway. Like the mummy. You know, the mummy, like he, both the original and the 90s one, he starts out all fucked up looking and he slowly becomes more and more human. Like, and the whole time to much a similar effect, you're still thinking about how he did look. And that makes it scarier, you know.
Yeah, and when he's
even the Boris Karloff one, I think is pretty creepy for that.
Early on, he's a corpse with two big googly eyes.
In the 90s. Also, like kind of porcelain. That's like the
yeah.
But yeah, no, I love it. I really do. I love the doll. And you know, while the film gets so much mileage out of match cuts. Not match cuts. What's the term for it when they, I guess just cutaways. Where, you know, we round a corner and the thing isn't there anymore, or the camera pans, you know, or something blocks the camera and they obviously cut to another shot, but it looks like it just disappeared. There's a lot of
it's
those.
A lot of plays on like spatial awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know.
Like, and I enjoyed it throughout the movie. They do it constantly. Like, in this film, there's, like, ghosts are appearing and disappearing.
Yeah.
And I never got tired of it. I was having fun the whole time. They do it a couple of times in the movie, but there's moments where someone backs into somebody, and then the camera cuts to a wide shot, and there's nobody there.
Yeah.
And I think it works really well. I think we've all had that kind of feeling or that experience, you know, like you back into something and your lizard brain is like person, and you turn around and it's just a cabinet or something, you know, and it's like, it worked for me quite well. The pacing, the timing, the cutting, the editing.
Yeah, I think that stuff works most effectively when there are like other people in the scene as well. Like that happens once with like one of the actors where it's like they're all like bunched together,
yeah,
like listening to the director talk about such and such, and one of them gets like, he sees something, gets kind of spooked, and he like backs up, and it's like,
oh, it's our actress. Yeah, cause yeah, it's well what's cool is it's several scares chained together to what I think is really great effect. It's they enter the hotel and the director is asking one of the actors to lie down in the same place that his, like, the person he's portraying,
oh, yeah,
dies. And I love that too. It, like the actor, like the director is like so committed to authenticity that he wants these actors to like lie down in the real places these people were killed.
Yeah.
And again, it all plays into authenticity, reenactment, ritual,
reincarnation.
Yeah.
And, recycling. So there's a cool, I love that. And yeah, so he has this guy lay down, and the producer is walking around and he's taking like pictures that can be used for documentation, press, or just for when they're filming later. It might
reference,
be for the set.
Reference photography.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, so he takes a photo, there's a flash, and our actress suddenly sees the real body there.
Yeah.
And they do this several times, and it sort of, and when they're in the main lobby, which I do love, the second floor, the gantry, and
it's got a big, it's got a big central staircase. Mm-hmm.
And then there's glass on either side, big glass windows, and we can see the destroyed court, like Japanese courtyard, and it's all desiccated. It really, yeah, it looks great. But anyway, yeah, so there's the flash, and she sees that, and she steps back, and then she bumps into someone, turns, no one's there. And then, as she's sort of realizing and reacting to that, behind her on the gantry, ghosts are walking around again. And it just really feels like the whole place is suddenly coming to life.
Yeah.
And they don't say it, but to me, it feels like it's happening because they're doing this ritual. You know, because they're putting these people back where they're supposed to be. And the threads are just sort of falling into place on their own. that no one has to be conscious for this ritual to happen is fucking neat. I think it's cool, man.
Yeah, well, and that there's obviously something that's drawing them to this place, mm-hmm. you know, in yeah, order
dark
to...
Dark Nexus, like you said.
Yeah, in order to get these pieces all in place for, you know, what needs to happen.
So a character that I also really liked was... she's actually... she's a person who appears next to our actress, protagonist, first, when she's auditioning. There's another actress who's a little more vocal and more confident, and she says that she would really love to have a death scene in the movie because in another life she died, and that she was strangled.
Did you recognize that actress?
It was Ringing Bells, who...
She plays herself in Neroy. She's the one who is out...
Really?
Yeah, who goes out to the graveyard with, like, the ghost hunters early on.
Yeah, she's the influencer.
Yeah. She's literally playing herself in Neroy. Like, she's using her real name.
Oh, shit! Yeah, she's great in that, too. I really love her. Mm-hmm. Fuck, that's so... Thank you. I'm so glad you said something. The actor who plays the murder father also... was ringing bells for me. I need to check on IMDb.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I didn't recognize him from anything.
But so during that scene where she's auditioning early on, she's also there and she talks about that. And I like it because it serves several points, like one, obviously reinforcing the themes of the story, but also she's very confident about it, and to the point where it's a little unsettling too. She's like kind of excited to tell them, like, "Yo, I was strangled in the past life," and like they're all kind of demurring, like, "Okay, okay."
It's like, "All right, bitch,
all right, yeah, sure." And then meanwhile, our protagonist is very timid and kind of looks away from the director and shies away, which is what the director's really looking for. So I like the utility of that. Like, it's all pretty clearly thought out. And then, our, strangled another life character, also appears before Vanilla Fudge.
Yeah.
Later on. And, so again, it's just one of those ways where, you know, while throughout the entire film, these two characters don't meet until the very end, there are still some threads between
them. Yeah, definitely.
You know, and I think without her, that character, it wouldn't have been enough. But to me, that's what kind of brings it home, is it, you know, like, okay, clearly they are still we have enough information to know that they are still in the same reality. It's not, like, they're not playing up that she was also her in a past life. There's no confusion there, you know? Like, so she meets Vanilla Fudge, and she starts, and she once again mentions that she was always drunk. And I love this detail, that she pulls her scarf down, and she shows that she actually has a mark at the base of her neck. That she's had all her life.
Yeah.
Like, physical evidence that she was killed in a previous life. And I like that, especially seeing it after the second time. Because mm-hmm. the first time she seems a little crazy. And the second time we get a little bit more, like, evidence of it. It's like, maybe she's really onto something.
Because at this point in the film, you know, like, our other protagonist, the actress, has been just, like, constantly having visions of, like, this little girl and her fucking spooky-ass doll. So it's like definitely like starting to set up the idea that like she was this little girl in a past life, and that like that is why she is, you know, seeing these things, because they're, you know, memories from her past life. So like, yeah, like you're saying, like, the other actress, when we see her at the beginning, she's talking about her past life, then she just sounds like a kook, but then all of this other stuff is happening that is, like, getting us thinking about past lives and, like, reliving and recycling and reincarnating, so on and so forth. So then the reintroduction of that character later, when she goes to talk to Vanilla Fudge, it's like, yeah, suddenly she seems much more credible.
Yes.
'Cause Vanilla Fudge got turned on to her because, like you're saying, she woke up from that dream in her class, and the teacher is talking about, like, you know, the
psychological... He's giving a lecture on the thing.
Yeah, exactly. He's giving a lecture on the thing, like, the psychological phenomena of, like, remembering things that didn't happen to you and deja vu, and he has like some like long technical scientific term for it. Like,
I like that her friend like walking out of the classroom can't remember. Yeah, he the name can't of it remember either, it. Just yeah, like us.
But like relatable. That's that, you know, that like gets her thinking like, oh, or yeah, you know, I have these dreams of this hotel, and so like her friend is like, oh yeah, I know this actress. And, you know, she has, like, experiences similar to what you're experiencing. So she's kind of weird, but, you know, like, I'll introduce you. I like how they set that up because, like, while you're waiting for her to show up, yeah, you're thinking that it's going to be, like, our other protagonist. And then it ends up being the other actress. But what that all leads up to is one of my favorite sequences in the movie is when they go to the library, and and the actress is kind of like they're looking through old like newspaper clippings and stuff about the massacre and all this stuff, and the actress gets a phone call, and so she goes off to take it, and she's like walking through the stacks of books. Oh, first there's the great part where like she's walking down one of the aisles and the camera kind of pans up and we see the doll sitting at the very top of the shelf, and it's like following her, its head is following her as she's walking, and then she like looks like through the shelf and there's just like a bunch of ghostly faces on the other side.
That's I think the ghost screamers were the most effective for me when there's like fucking 11 of them.
Yeah.
You know, like the truck scare, like the opening sequence of the film, like with the trucker.
Early on,
like,
yeah,
when we see all of them in the woods, like fucked up, man.
That's so spooky. Well, because it's dark. The woods are dark and you can just see all of their like white faces.
Yeah. And then too, like when he's in the truck and he's panicking after he's gone back inside and he's leaning back and then just all of them are in there with him. Like,
yeah.
It's great. And again, just all practical, just a bit of like baby powder and makeup, you know, and that's all it takes. And coordinating, you know, like,
yeah,
you know, like 15 people. But that's all it takes to really bring that scare home. And I respect it a lot. Again,
yeah.
It's so well paced. It's always timed as a shock just to see so many
faces.
It's
really effective in the library scene, and it's really effective in the hit and run or the accident scene as well. Do you guys feel like it goes to the well on that too often?
I like it.
A little bit, I do, yeah.
It does...
Well, see, I agree with Cleve. Like, I think it's most effective in those scenes where we get all of the ghosts together. And I think that some of those other instances where there's just, like, one ghost, or like the one where like the dude is like washing his hands in the bathroom, it's the truck driver, I guess, washing his hands in the bathroom, he looks at his face and his face kind of like warps a little bit and it's like one of the ghost faces. Some of that stuff I think is a little silly.
Yeah.
not as spooky.
Yeah, I mean that one especially, it's like they use CG at times in this movie, and I think honestly most of the time it works for me.
It's pretty good.
That's
yeah.
an example where it doesn't really work super well.
I'll tell you one place where I really like the CG in this movie is the intro credits.
Yeah,
I think they bop. I think they rule. I think it's dated in all the right ways. Like it's the textures are really fun to look at as we just sort of descend down that ominous tunnel of liquid goo.
A vortex. A dark vortex.
Dark fucking vortex. A
Tool
dark
music video coded.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Somebody teased at the end. Movie, yeah.
Yeah, it's like the end of the music video for Parabola, when it just becomes like a psychedelic tunnel.
Yeah, and it works. Themes. It does fit.
Mm-hmm.
I like those effects, and yeah, again, like dated in a wonderful way. I think that they're still fun to look at, and I think still unsettling, too, which is hard to say for a lot of CG from that era. But yeah, so yeah. let's see. Let's go back to the library because I want to touch on how that finishes up.
Yeah, that's not quite. Because we didn't quite finish that.
By this point, we have a sense that the ghosts want people and can almost prey on them, like when they're in certain situations. You know, like they're kind of close to their previous selves or something. We're not sure yet. But at this point, she's in the library. She's in an entirely different place, and we see the power of these ghosts, that the hands come out from behind the shelves and they all grab her, and then she's just pulled upwards and up and up and up, and to the point where then Vanilla Fudge is looking for her, and she comes around the corner and she doesn't see it, but we see the legs,
her feet, yeah, going up out of the top of the
descend,
shot
or ascend out of the shot, and then she's just gone and spirited away. And that this place is so powerful that it can just pull people into it.
Well, it's
like,
cool.
That is fucking awesome to me. Like, and earnestly spooky. Like that whole, like, it's very fae, you know, like that idea. Of,
what's
know?
Cool is that it immediately cuts from that to the sort of like POV shots, like flying through the mountains and like going into the tunnel and like physically like flying to the hotel, but then when it actually gets there, we see that it's from the perspective of our main protagonist,
the actress.
So like that, yeah, but when it starts, it's like it could as well just be the other actress who we saw get spirited away. One of the things I do really like, last thing I want to touch on that scene, is that, like, you know, she sees the ghost through the shelf in front of her, and that causes her to back up against the books behind her in fright and drop her phone, and then all the hands come out from the shelves behind her.
Sequencing, man. Yeah. Good fucking blocking and staging.
Yeah.
Planning. Like, sequence your shit. Like, it just, like, yeah. It makes such a difference. I'd be curious to see, like, what, you know, if this film had many storyboards as well. But, like, it's clearly, like, thought through, like, carefully. And I wanted to touch on that, because you're asking me, like, going back to the well. And I agree and I don't agree. I agree in that it isn't scary every time. But to me, it's fun every time.
Sure.
And I think that's
fair.
You know, like, and that's just personal preference. But,
Sure, I agree that it's fun every time. I do think that because of all of the repetition, it makes some of the sequences that should hit the hardest hit quite as hard.
Interesting, yeah.
Because we're so saturated by ghosts at this point.
That's the thing about stews. They're a little watery. Just a little watered down. But they're still good. I like sipping on them.
A stew shouldn't be too watery. That's a soup. A stew is chunky and thick. Like Vanilla Fudge.
Like Vanilla Fudge. I'd say this movie is chunky and thick. I'll give it that.
Yeah, well, to bring the two together, maybe it's a little bit over-chunked.
Oh, okay.
Maybe it's a little bit too chunky with it's ghosts. Good. It's not watery, it's too chunky.
Campbell's chunky.
You lose some of the juice.
The juice, yeah.
Movie has the juice to an extent.
It's got the juice, yeah, absolutely. No, it's absolutely got the juice. And why don't we get into, like, the last, like, 15, 20 minutes of the movie, sure, where it's all sort of been culminating to, and where we get a fun subversion of expectations.
I think a great one.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think also, What makes this last part of the film work so well is I think it's very, very well edited, because this is where we are culminating several things, and it's intercutting between three sort of actions that all converge really nicely. Our main protagonist, our main actress, they're on set in the studio where they've built the replica of the hotel, and they're starting to shoot some of her scenes. And at the same time, Vanilla Fudge has been pulled into a dream or something where she's wandering around the actual, like, dilapidated hotel.
We spoke a little bit about that hotel location, mm-hmm. but I love how they get the mileage out of it between dilapidated and like really nice.
Yeah, and how they go back and forth yeah. between those
well,
yeah. two.
And, well, and before we even go to the hotel, also we see that wonderful like tiny scale model.
Oh yeah, the little yeah the
yeah, but even yeah, even with that too, like they not only jump between dilapidated and like you know well maintained, they also jump between reality and the set.
Right.
So it's all blended together, and it all gets intercut.
And also some found footage, too, mm-hmm. at this time as well, because from some of our protagonist's visions that we've seen, we see of the killer, the crazy professor, is that as he's going through the hotel killing, he's got a handheld Super 8 mm-hmm. camera. So he is, like, POV filming his murders.
And I like that that's set up in one of the visions. It's not told to us.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when she's like, when they're at the hotel the first time and she's like being chased by him, like, you know, she's following the path that the little girl took and she ends up in the room and like hides in like the cupboard or whatever.
I love how that sequence is shot, mm-hmm. by the way. It feels so Halloween, you know,
yeah.
with
yeah.
the lights coming through the little, you know,
the slat. Yeah.
You know. I also realized, we were kind of jumping around. I know you were...
Yeah, we're all over the place now.
Beginning to break down the ending. But there was one thing I realized we should definitely touch on before we get to the ending. And that is a pretty crucial scene where our actress protagonist goes to visit one of the... Well... survivors. She wasn't there.
This is Vanilla Fudge.
Was that Vanilla Fudge?
It was Vanilla Fudge.
Oh, I guess I did it too. guilty as charged.
That was one of the scenes where she's wearing the Vanilla Fudge shirt too, yeah. So that makes it... Yeah, she goes... Well, she goes to visit the widow of the killer.
The family.
The sole survivor. And she... She lets... Vanilla Fudge see like his notebook, like what he was researching, and talks about how he got like obsessed with this idea of past lives or whatever. And it, you know, he's got a lot of like fun scribblings in his, you know, crazy mm-hmm. mad scientist notebook. The flesh is only a vessel.
I do love that she says that at first she thought it was all crazy ramblings, but the more that she read, the more that she believed.
Yeah.
And that's important, because, yeah, for reasons. But, yeah. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that yeah, we did set her up now.
Right. Yeah, well, and that's important, too, because it gives context for why he was filming, because she said that she believed that he was performing an experiment.
Right.
So he got obsessed with this idea of past lives and whether, you know, we carry our memories with us after we die, so on and so forth. So that drove him crazy, and he decided to kill a bunch of people and film it to figure out something. I don't really know. And so this culmination at the end of the film is we're cutting between Vanilla Fudge, who is in a dream or in the spirit world or whatever, walking around the hotel and seeing, like, all of the ghosts. And we're also seeing at the same time the POV footage of the killer that our protagonist's, like, agent is watching. And we're also seeing our protagonist as they're shooting, and she's sort of like, you know, she's acting and she's running through the halls and falling on the floor. She looks back at the camera and all of the camera crew like disappears and like fades away except for the director.
I like that it happens one at a time too.
Yeah. And so all of these things are cutting together more and more closely until they eventually become one space, basically. Because it starts out as, like, three distinct spaces, the set, the actual hotel, the footage of the murder, and it all eventually sort of gains parity and becomes one. And so, like, what's really cool is that, like, when everybody but the director fades away and he starts, like, following her down the hallway, it's like, oh, shit, he's the killer reincarnated. They kind of set that up too with the scene earlier on where she's like hiding in the cabinet and he opens up the door and it's the director instead of the killer.
And also just him talking about how the killer will never be seen. He's a shadowy figure. Like, he's the one saying that. So it kind of also kind of further implies.
Yeah. And you know, the killer was filming, he's behind the camera. The director's behind the camera. So they're setting all this up as like, oh, he is the reincarnation of the killer, and our protagonist is the reincarnation of the little girl.
Yeah, and I think that the low-hanging fruit, like the almost like too obvious thing that could have happened here is that suddenly they're shooting the scene, they've got the whole cast there, and then the director just starts killing everyone.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm glad they didn't go that route.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love how well the movie like blurs the lines of reality in this sequence, which I do feel like is a little bit undercut by the very end, but we'll get to that. But yeah, so like as the director's like coming down the hall towards her, then he sort of like falters and falls, and we see him overlaid and become the little boy with the bouncy ball. We haven't talked about him, but he's the little girl's sister. And it's like, oh shit, if the director's the little boy, then who's the killer?
Because this whole time, the actress has just been following after this memory of the little girl, of who she is, and she's been trying to figure out and understand it, and she's been following what we think is her ghost as right. the little girl.
And the way they start setting up this subversion, too, is that as Vanilla Fudge is wandering around the hotel, she finds the doll and she starts carrying it. So she's wandering around the hotel carrying this doll, and she ends up in the room, and our actress comes in and she opens up the closet, and Vanilla Fudge is in there, and it overlays her with the little girl. It's like, ah, she was the reincarnation of the little girl all along. And then that's the ultimate reveal, that our main protagonist, our actress, is the reincarnated killer.
And I love that, like the whole movie, and I was buying it right up until the very end, right up to the moment I should have been, which is really nice. I was really buying that she was a little girl and she's just following after the memory of it. But no, she's the whole time, the whole fucking movie, she's following after the little girl because she's the one chasing her.
Exactly.
And she doesn't even know it. And we don't know it. And like, it did it. It like, it made us feel like we were reincarnated, you know, as the viewer. And that's fucking cool, man.
It's very deftly handled because like it sets up the red herring in like such an unsubtle way that, I mean, I totally, for most of the film, took it at face value. Yeah. It's like, okay, yeah, it's like, obviously she's the little girl reincarnated. So then to have that reveal that, like, and you said, yeah, she's chasing the little girl because she is the killer.
Yeah. And what's cool is, like...
Yeah, it's such a nice revelation.
Why I'm really gratified by it, too, is I guessed it, I think, about a minute before it happened.
Yeah, like you said, you guess, like, I had the same thing. It's like, you guess it right when you should.
Yeah, it's like the movie actually, like, detected you through it and held your hand just enough that you have that realization with them.
Yeah, it's, you have
the movie
doesn't just
give you the realization out of the blue and then pieces it all together. You actually culminate there.
You have,
that's fucking hard to do. That's good writing.
And it gives you just a minute to feel smart that you've solved the mystery before it tells you, before it gives you the answer, even though it's led you there all along. I know that. I mean, that's good writing. That's good storytelling. Like that's a good, a good, satisfying reveal. And, you know, like we've been saying, like this stuff really does, I think, ultimately justify some of the problems that I have with earlier parts of the movie. You see the necessity for those things. That's not to say that those things aren't handled kind of clumsily, but the payoff is so effective, I think.
What I really love about the payoff of, you know, the reincarnation of the killer is, you know, he's doing an experiment to see what memories pass on
right
to the next life, and kind of that ends up being his haunting, you know, in the end through yeah. her. Not only do faint memories pass on, also your sins will also pass on.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, and this filmmaker loves a vengeful ghost. And what I like about this too is that, like, her realization that she is the killer does not come with, like, a maniacal evil turn or anything. Like, she receives it with just as much horror as we do, and she is then set upon by all of the other ghosts that have been brought to this place as well. That it's all been pulling her back here so their ghosts can take vengeance upon her ghost. That is really great. She flees the hotel, and they're still cutting this back and forth with the found footage. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing that, like, she is retracing his last steps, like she's running through town, and
well, and before she leaves the hotel itself too, she rounds the corner, and we see Madame Strangle.
Oh yeah,
hoisted up.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. I love that. Yeah, we do because that they linger on that the most, because like she transforms and she's strung up on the wall, and then she just starts like quaking and shaking. Like,
yeah, there. Well, and this is
it's cool too, because if I remember correctly, like, I don't think we see that on the Super 8. Like, it's I don't know if that ghost was actually one of the 11 that was killed by.
Yeah, she was the maid. Yeah. She was the maid. Okay. Yeah. Cool. Well, and like the truck driver at the beginning, we see that he was like the front desk guy.
Yeah.
The dude, like the businessman who we didn't talk about that, but also at the beginning, like we see him run into a ghost in the in like the elevator. He's there at the end. So like, yeah, this is, you know, sort of it's like, yeah, all of these seemingly like unconnected, like supernatural things we see in like the very first few minutes of the film is like these ghosts being gathered, pulled from their current lives back into their past lives. But yeah, so she/our killer, you know, running through the streets, goes into a house, and this part was fucking awesome. Mm-hmm. Because not in the found footage, but in like what the quote unquote reality that she's experiencing, the doll comes up the stairs, and we get a fucking awesome little stop motion sequence of the doll.
We get the classic like J-horror aesthetic of like long black hair.
Yeah, over the face. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and
it's great. Yeah, it's like you get like the spooky elements of like J horror, and then also like the fucked up like Ray Harryhausen shit too. And it what a cool combination.
It feels very Child's Play inspired.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Especially when like her face morphs.
Yeah,
and it talks.
Yeah, yeah, but together forever.
Frankly. Much scarier than Child's Play. Child's Play is fun. I don't really find it scary.
Yeah, I mean, Child's
Play. This I find fucking creepy as fuck.
Totally like, different tones.
Absolutely.
That stop motion stuff looks fucking great. And I'm so happy that they elected to do that practically instead of CG. Because at the time this movie came out, they could have chosen to do a CG doll instead of a stop motion one.
And it's aged really well because of it. I think, yeah. And while it's walking up to her, she's looking for something to defend herself with, and she picks up a piece of glass, and I really, really, really like this, that she holds up the glass, and for a second she looks into it, and she sees the killer's face reflected where she should be, and then we cut to her, her agent, watching the Super 8 footage, and the killer holds up his knife and sees her face in it.
Yeah.
And that's cool.
I like that.
That.
The piece of glass that she picks up too is the exact same shape of the knife as well. It's like one of those it's like a fucking Scream knife, like the big handled knife with like the blade with a little curve at the front.
She sees his face, he sees her face.
Mm-hmm.
They are one in that moment, and then the doll finally comes up to her. and or she stabs himself first.
Yeah, in the found footage, he stabs himself.
And we
get
that wonderful blood spurt, you know, and then the doll approaches, kind of falls into her lap, and we look into its face, and they do this really fucked up puppeted, like, plastic, latex, like face, like, where it's the puppet's face, but it's also, like, I think they put it over a person's face, and it's real fucked up looking, and...
I think there's probably an animatronic.
Yeah, honestly, that looks strikingly similar to Chucky.
Yeah, that's what you were talking about.
The technicality of it.
Yeah,
that was probably a little bit of an animatronic, I think. But yeah, the doll then, like, takes her hand with the knife and sort of, like, forces it to her neck, and we go to black. And personally, I think the movie should have ended right there. We get a little like 3 to 5 minute epilogue that is fine, I guess, but I feel like it kind of muddies the waters a little bit.
Interesting. I almost felt like it made things more certain.
Well, you know what? I mean, yes, technically you're correct. I think a more sort of ambiguous ending where what is real and what is dream and what is spirit is kind of ambiguous, I think that's more satisfying.
Yeah, we should get our conclusion.
You're right. The epilogue doesn't muddy things. It clarifies things, which, for the purpose of my metaphor, I think muddy is what makes the other ending so good. But anyway, after it cuts to black, then we see, like, a bunch of executives or whatever watching, like, the dailies of the film, and we're seeing, you know, from the camera's perspective as the actress is, like, running through the hallways, and, you know, we see the great look of fear on her face as... from what we've seen earlier where she saw everybody disappearing, but then she basically just starts having, like, a seizure, and we see, like, some production assistants, like, run in and, like, try to help her and stuff, and for some reason the killer's widow is at that screening of dailies.
She found her way in just out of curiosity is sort of what I thought. She's been watching the whole time. She's been sort of aware. She studied the husband's notes. Like,
right.
I think that, and through that, she
but this isn't
found
like,
her chance for revenge.
But this isn't like a public screening. Like, why would they let her in there to watch the dailies?
Because she was a survivor of the killer about what the movies are about. Like, I mean, they do consultation.
Yeah,
like,
I guess.
I think that's not that far-fetched to me. So she sees that, and then...
We cut to our protagonist in an asylum.
In a straitjacket.
Yeah.
Yeah, she clearly had some sort of manic episode on set. And I kind of like that there's, like, a dual reality where, you know, in her eyes, all the people disappeared during that scene, and she was transported to the hotel, and all these revelations occurred, and the, quote, reality of it is that she was transported away in her mind, and she was, you know, brought to insanity by all these ghosts haunting her. And so now, and, you know, with her big revelation, she's just gone entirely mad. And she's in her padded cell, and... The survivor widow looks in through the window. And I love that the survivor widow is almost played up as a jump scare too. That, like, our killer actress, like, looks up and just sees, again, another ghost from their past almost. And I like it because, again, like, we've been seeing this film through that protagonist's eyes for so much of it, that even as the killer, we're still kind of relating with her, and we're also made to kind of be afraid now of this wife. Of this regret, you know, of this decision to murder her family. And then, like, through the food slot at the bottom of the door, I think first comes the ball.
Right? No, the doll.
The doll unceremoniously gets dumped into it with a cracked eye. And then
she also puts the boy's ball
in. And then the ball bounces in. And I like it because they play through the ending with the ball bouncing, then the doll is with her instead.
Yeah.
And, she starts panicking and freaking out. And I kind of like that she gets vengeance. I think it's kind of neat that, like, off screen, the widow at first just thought her husband went insane and murdered her children and then himself. And then she, through studying his notes, realized that, like, oh, he was trying to do this thing with reincarnation.
Yeah.
Figures it out, puts the pieces together that her husband is now alive again in this world and that she can get her revenge. I think that's kind of fun. Like, it's yeah. a lot, and it is muddy, as you say, and I think that cutting it out would have been better. I don't disagree with you, but yeah. I do still like it.
I mean, I think it's okay.
It's just not as satisfying because, like, she's only in, like, one scene before it, and at the end, you know, like, it feels like it's kind of an addendum.
Like, yeah, and also, like, I don't know, it's like the events of the film are played up to be, like, pretty explicitly supernatural because, like, multiple people have experiences with the supernatural, and, like, you know, the other actress, like, does get fucking, you know, pulled up into the sky by ghosts in the library, and then to just, like, have it all end for our protagonist is like, oh, it's all in her. She's just crazy. It's like, no, well,
I think it did. I think those things did happen. I think it's Cake and Eat It too. Like, the ghost did pull that person away. All of that stuff did happen.
So the ghosts killed those people for real, but didn't kill their killer and just left her to go mad.
I don't think the ghosts killed anybody. They just pulled them back to those locations where they were originally killed.
And in so doing, killing their present selves. I mean, I think that's pretty explicit.
Yeah, to me that feels like more it's like part of the ritual. But yeah, I guess
because see like their present selves dead as ghosts wandering around the hotel. And so, like, and...
Yeah, I thought it was, so, like, more like a nebulous so memory, what, I see where you're going, yeah.
So what happened to the director? Like, did he... Like, we see her, and we see in the footage, we see her seizing right, out, but yeah. What happened to him? Because he's one of the ghosts, too, right? See, that's what I'm saying, where it's, like, by making sort of, like, a definitive statement there at the conclusion, I think it actually kind of like confuses yeah, some of its no, other stuff that, yeah. And I think that like yeah the ambiguity of just ending it there with her with like the doll in her lap and the doll like trying to like force this shard of glass into her throat, and it's like just end it there. It's like, okay, what was happening in reality, what's the spirit world, what is dream, you know, like that I think is way it fits I feel like the ethos of the film way better than having like sort of a more concrete ending like it does. I don't disagree with what you're saying about like that sense of justice for the widow or whatever. Like I think it's not like in terms of like from a filmmaking perspective, like it's not badly done. I just think it kind of undercuts what makes the culmination of all of this stuff, like, so effective.
It's like they finished a really good speech, you know, it culminated really well, and they had, and one more thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it just kind
of... It's one bite of stew too much. It's too much.
One too many ingredients.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Well, yeah, okay. Well, I think that pretty well...
Yeah, I'm ready to rate this if you guys are. Somebody else want to start? I'm kind of teetering, I think.
I'm teetering, too.
Ben? I'll go first. Yeah. I really like this movie. I think it's stronger than The Grudge. You know, I do have a few problems with the very ending being convoluted and kind of the repetition kind of undercutting how hard some of the scares hit. But it still is very atmospheric. I like the set. I like the creepy doll. Yeah, I'm going to give this a 3.5 out of 5. Definitely worth a watch.
Yeah, I think I'm going to give it the same. I was kind of teetering between that and a 4. And maybe this could be a 4 on a future rewatch. Because I do think that, you know, like I was saying, by the end, it does kind of justify a number of the problems I had with the early parts of the film. But that being said, like, I was still kind of, like, struggling to stay engaged through some of that stuff, like, on this watch. I'll be curious to see if that changes in the future. But for now, yeah, I think I'm going to give it a strong 3.5 out of 5.
Yeah, the context of the climax, the big twist, really made me enjoy the front half of the film even more, and I was happy to have experienced all of those things to get to it. I didn't mind that by the end. And especially too, like, talking out all of the threads, like, over the course of the podcast kind of helped reaffirm that.
Helps,
with me.
Yeah.
Like, that like, yeah, no, the way those things happened, the way that they did it, the pace that they did for that reason. Like, and for that, to me, that culmination to be so gratifying. However, also talking through all of that stuff, I do kind of agree about the ending now even more so. So, like, there is that too. But I think my head is saying 3.5, but honestly, I personally did have, like, such a really good experience out of this movie, and I appreciate what it did so well. I am gonna give it, like, just a good 4. Like, just a really solid 4. Yeah, that extra little bump.
Alright. Well, that will give Reincarnation an average of 3.7 out of 5. Thanks to Micah for recommending it. This is definitely a worthwhile discussion.
Yeah, honestly, thank you, Micah. Well, much better than the last. with fucking Twilight.
Yeah, thanks for not making us watch another Twilight movie. I really appreciate that. Just quick tangent. I was looking through this director's filmography. I didn't realize that he also did the American remake of The Grudge and its sequel, but more surprisingly, in 2014 he did a live action remake of Kiki's Delivery Service.
What?
A Japanese one. Yeah, strange. Not a film that needs a live action remake, but I am kind of curious.
Yeah, I guess let him cook his stew.
Yeah.
Right?
Anyway, next week it's Ben's pick. Ben, do you want to talk about?
Yeah,
what
I'm
we're
super
seeing next
excited
week?
To cover this one. You know, on Letterboxd you get to pick your top 4 movies, and in mine I have 2 non-horror movies and 2 horror-ish movies. One is The Hitcher that we've talked about, Golden Pod. The other is Miracle Mile, one of my all-time favorite films. I'm so excited to kind of show it to you guys for the first time. We're going to see it at the Alamo Draft House.
Yeah, that's exciting. Yeah, I'm excited for my first Miracle Mile experience to be on the big screen. That's always special.
It's a trip, and I'm super excited to talk about it.
Hell yeah. Join us next week for our review of Miracle Mile. Now we have some prediction results for last week's episode for Abigail.
We do. So I'll start with box office. Cleve, you said Abigail would make $800,000 at the box office opening weekend.
Why did I go that low?
I don't know. TC said 10 mil.
Are you sure I did?
Yeah.
I will say, before we do these results, when we predicted this, we did not even have a title for this movie yet.
Yeah, it was Untitled Radio Silence.
But even then,
movie.
It was Radio Silence with... Oh, did I miss a zero? Is
no,
that what happened
no,
there?
No, you put 800K. You definitely didn't miss a zero.
Yeah, so we did not have much... When we were making these predictions, we did not have much to go off of. We didn't even have a title. I think we had cast, and that was about it.
Yeah.
And that it was a monster. I think we had a log line and a cast.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. So TC said 10 mil. I said 11 mil opening weekend. It did 10.3.
Ha ha!
So, T gets that one.
Yes, just barely. Wow, I was really close on that one.
In terms of Rotten Tomatoes, Cleve, you said it would get a 60. TC, you said 82. And I said 87. Right now, it's sitting at an 83.
Sheesh!
That one again.
Deserved.
Very
so,
close.
Collective rating, Cleve, you said 3.5. TC said 3.8, and I said 4.
Okay, you got that
yes,
one.
Yes, it got a 4.2 from us, if I remember correct.
Like, that is correct.
Kill count, Cleve, you said 6, TC said 4, and I said 9.
Cleve, you were right on the fucking money.
Exactly
it was
6.
Yeah. Exactly 6.
Boom.
Nice one.
And finally, who would rate it the highest? Cleve, you said yourself.
I was right.
And then Tease and I said me.
Cleve was right on that one.
Get that one.
Hey,
nice. Sheesh. So we all get points this time around. Cleve, your comment was Dan Stevens hot.
Factual.
He's kind of schlubby in that movie, though.
Yeah. It was fine. TC said, hard to really predict anything specific without a trailer or even a title, but I'm hoping this is a return to form for Radio Silence after Scream 6. Cautiously optimistic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I said, I hope this is more like Ready or Not and less like Scream. And
you're right.
Exactly. Yeah, we had basically the same comment in different words. All right. Hell yeah. Nice. Well, before we wrap up, you want to do a sponsor for us real quick, Cleveman?
Yeah, do a quick little sponsor. The shelf.
A little sponsy.
Rings out and calls to us from dreams and beyond, taking us to places we've been many times before. And will be again. This episode is brought to you by your sins that only God sees. You know what they are, and that's for you.
And you'll carry them with you into your next life and the life after that.
Reincarnation.
Reincarnation. All right, well, that'll bring us to the end of this week's episode. If you like the show, don't forget to leave us a rating and review wherever you're listening to this. Hit the 5 stars, if you please.
All 5.
You can also, of course, become a Patreon supporter at patreon.com/podpeoplepod. Shout out to our honorary pod boys, Sam, Zach, Micah, and Mitchell. Special shout out to Micah for choosing the film we talked about this week. If you want to choose movies for us to talk about, go to Patreon and give us $10 a month. You can also follow us at letterboxd.com/podpeoplepod. Where you'll find a list of all the films we've talked about on the show with our average ratings and links to those reviews. My quick recommendation this week is a cold recommendation because I think both of y'all have recommended it already, but I've finally been watching Shogun. I'm a little over halfway through, it's fucking great. I've been having a fantastic time with it. Oh, yeah.
Well, in the spirit of reincarnation, I'm going to recommend another J-horror movie. It's a movie called Kodoko, by Shinya Tsukamoto, the guy who directed Tetsuo. It's about a woman struggling with her sanity, seeing continual hallucinations of other people she knows and maybe does not know. Some of them go to violently attack her, some, you know, are just spooky. So it's a very cool, interesting movie. From Tsukamoto.
In the spirit of reincarnation, I'm going to recommend Hinduism. Try it out. my recommendation is going to be, I mean, Hinduism is pretty cool, honestly, as religions go. But I'm going to recommend an artist that you should just look at their paintings of. I think I should be doing that more often, being an artist myself. This week, I'm going to recommend the works of Lord Frederick Leighton. Who's one of my all-time favorite painters. He did Flaming June with Banger. A really, really fantastic piece of Orpheus and Eurydice. Also one of my favorite is just a study of his. It's just a drawing of a lemon tree. And it is so incredibly intricate. You can see, like, several layers of leaves back in it. Just this very simple hand drawing. Apparently it was... It was such a strain on his eyes that he had to lie down with, like, a washcloth over his face for, like, 2 days because it strained his eyes so much. And it shows in the drawing. It's fucking awesome and worth it. So, yeah, go check out some of his paintings.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening. We have come to the death of this episode of Pod People, but fear not. We will be reborn anew next week.
And almost certainly tortured by our past ghosts.
Good night.
Somewhere between a lover and a friend. It was different back then. Surreal.